From rare birds to wild deer, we've got plenty of wildlife information to talk about today, and I hope you'll join in too. Hi, Jill Nadeau here, in for Larry Mueller today on the Ideas Network. David Drake joins me in the studio. David is a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist. We'll talk about a citizen science project aimed at collecting data on the state's deer herd, as well as an upcoming urban wildlife workshop that you may be interested in attending. And as always, we're welcoming your questions and comments about wildlife in Wisconsin. So join the conversation. Call us at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And you can also post photos and comments on the Larry Mueller Facebook page. And we already have a few really nice trail cam shots, David.
We do.
They're deer.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
which helps us segue to our first question. Why don't you tell us about Operation Deer Watch?
Okay, this is a statewide citizen science effort that's started by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and this is one of many citizen science efforts that you could get involved with. So we'll talk specifically about this one right now. But essentially, what the DNR is asking for is anybody in the state, be it a hunter or non-hunter, deer lover or non-deer lover, is anytime between August 1st and September 30th, so for the next 2 months, anytime you see a buck, which is a male deer, and at this time of the year, they should have antlers on their heads, does, the female deers, and then fawns, the deer that have been born this year. Anytime you see bucks, does, or fawns, to report the location and numbers of those, and you can go to the DNR website, so you can just Google Wisconsin DNR, and then once you're at the DNR website, and their keywords search box, just type in deer watch, okay. And there's an online tally sheet, and you can then tally the number of bucks, does, and fawns you've seen the day, and I think they also ask for location.
Okay.
At the very least, they ask for county. And so this helps the DNR to understand roughly the reproduction that occurred this past season, how many deer, in terms of a census number, how many deer might be out there in the state. And then this helps. This is one of the many things that goes into factoring into deer herd management. So it helps us set deer harvest levels and things like that.
Okay, well, that sounds like a pretty easy way to become involved
in it. Yep.
And you had talked about other citizen science projects. Mm-hmm. Can they just go to the same site and just Google in or ask, put in the question box, citizen science projects?
Yeah, you can certainly do that through the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources site, but there's plenty of other citizen science projects that are not necessarily attached to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. So the better thing maybe to do is citizen science in Wisconsin.
There's some kind of a search.
Internet search through that,
okay.
And then there'll be many of other pops up. But you know, within the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, we're talking about citizen science and the deer herd watch right now, but there's Snapshot Wisconsin, which is a big project that is being rolled out continuously, where they're asking landowners to put wildlife cameras on their property and then report the pictures in. In the spring and through the summer, you can do the frog and toad survey if you want. There's plenty of bird citizen science going on, Christmas bird counts that will occur around Christmas time, breeding bird surveys that are occurring in the spring and early summer. We've got a project I'm involved with the Urban Canid Project. We ask people to report fox and coyote sightings in and around Madison. So there's a bunch of them that are associated with the DNR, but there's also a number of citizen science projects that are independent of the DNR.
And all sound like a good time.
Especially, it is.
Family, you know, can do this together, especially now that school's out.
Yep, absolutely. It's a great thing to do. And, you know, we hear so much about kids in particular being inside and attached to whatever electronic device they've got in their hands. And this is a wonderful way to get out and explore the outdoors, get some fresh air, a little exercise. And again, it's a wonderful thing to do as a family.
Well, and speaking of deer, we have a call from Mike in Castle Rock. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm not going to talk about deer because I think somebody else will discuss that. But what I wanted to mention is that I drive back and forth to town, the local town here in Fenimore, but also in other towns. And it used to be I would clean the windshields from the bug splatter. And I had some spray stuff down in the basement that I used to use. Now the windshields are clean all over. And, you know, I don't get any barn swallows under my deck anymore. Or the bridges, there's fewer. and I'm just not seeing a lot of insects.
Okay, well, what do you think, David? Is there just fewer, or are cars being made better so we don't have...
Well, Mike, I have also noticed that I've not had to clean my windshield as much with going on. And I will give you my kind of layperson's answer, not being an insect expert or entomologist, and maybe next time Phil Pelteri or P.J. Leish are on...
A couple of weeks.
Call back in and ask them, because they may have a more educated answer for you. But certainly, you know, with wildlife populations, we have... peak breeding seasons and reproductive seasons, where we have, you know, typically in the spring and early summer, that's where most of the young are born or hatched and things like that. And it's not coincidence that those animals are also populating the environment at the same time that you have this plethora of food on the landscape, one being insects. And so insects also hatch out in peak times and things like that. And I think what might be going on right now is certainly insects are affected by the weather systems and the environment and things like that, but they also have insect hatch peaks. And I think now we're starting to get into the end of summer here, we just may not be having as many insects hatching out, so you may not have quite as many insects just out and about in the environment. So that may be what's going on, Mike. But again, for a more educated answer, call in next time you hear PJ or Phil on the radio about insects.
What about the swallows he was talking about? Have we had a decrease in swallows?
Nope, it's the same type of thing. As you know, most of the birds now have finished their reproductive season for the year. There still are some birds that are trying to get one last hatch in. But you know, most of the animals, once they're no longer tied to that nest or that nest site, they're not concentrated in that particular area. And so people, they're still around, and you will certainly see them, but you may not see them as regularly or in the numbers that you saw in a small concentrated area, simply because they're not tied to that nest site any longer like they were earlier in the summer.
And wildlife changes, right? I mean, they don't always stay in the same spot, so you have to kind of keep that in mind, right?
Absolutely. They're there for whatever the resource is, be it a nesting resource or a food resource, and especially with insects being a mobile food resource, if that resource moves, then animals that are utilizing that resource, they also have to move with that food resource.
Right. Well, and I'll be happy to send you some of my mosquitoes if you're really missing those insects.
Yeah, me too, Mike.
Well, let's go back to the phones now. Jeff in Milwaukee. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
How are you today? Well, I'm doing well. What question do you have?
Great. Okay. Well, I wanted to explain something I saw a turkey doing earlier this spring. It was kind of some strange behavior from my perspective. But quickly about deer, my neighbor reported, because we have a cornfield right next to our apartment, that 11-point buck and a younger buck were on the edge of the cornfield eating the field corn. And it's raw in its raw condition, not when it's all dried and hanging down and ready to be picked. They were already eating it. But what I saw, this turkey flying across the field one day early in the spring before the corn was up. And first I thought it had a white head. And then I grabbed the binoculars and I looked, and she was carrying something in her beak. And she set it down amongst a group of crows and then walked away. And then the crows started picking at it, and then I was soon to see some albumin dripping, and I realized it was an egg. She brought an egg down and left it for these crows. Is that normal behavior for turkeys?
Well, it's interesting. So turkeys are ground nesting birds, and most birds that are nesting on the ground, we call them altricial birds. So as soon as their young hatch out, because they're on the ground, those birds are susceptible or vulnerable to predation and you know, insects and all sorts of other things like that. So typically, those birds that are ground nesters or altricial birds, that they get those young moving away from the nest pretty quickly, within hours of all the young hatching out. Birds that nest in trees are precocial nesters, for example, cardinals or blue jays or something like that. And those birds, because they're concealed in a nest and camouflaged in a nest, they may, once the young hatch out, those young may stay in that nest for 2 weeks or so until they fledge or gain enough feathers that they can leave the nest. Those precocial birds, it's not uncommon that they'll take the eggshells away from the nest and drop them as they fly overhead, simply because if you think about an egg that you may have dropped in your kitchen floor, if you don't clean all that up, it starts to stink pretty good pretty quickly. And so by moving the eggshells away from the nest, they're removing the scent that may draw predators like raccoons or skunk or whatever the case is. So it's a bit unusual for a turkey to do that. And you know, but however, the fact that they dropped it into the crows, crows are a pretty aggressive bird, and they certainly will go and eat eggs, and they'll also eat young birds. And I'm wondering if the turkey wasn't trying to feed the crows just to move them away from where those turkeys are. So who knows exactly what they were doing. But and it is a little unusual for a turkey to do that. It's not terribly unusual for songbirds and birds that are nesting in traditional nests to do that.
Well, Jeff, it sounds like you saw a pretty unique thing there. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that was pretty neat.
Our guest today is David Drake. He's a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist. I'm sure you have a wildlife question you'd like to ask of him, so give us a call. Our number is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas at WPR.org. So, you know, turning to another topic here, I understand that the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison is, and there's some other agencies in there too, is offering an urban wildlife project workshop in September.
Yes.
What's that all about?
Yes. So myself and Jamie Knack, who's usually here on the radio with
Jamie's
me, but
here
Jamie had other things to do today, so she abandoned us.
She did.
And then a couple of our colleagues in the Dane County Extension Office, who are horticultural educators over there, we're offering an urban wildlife workshop to homeowners, but anybody who lives in urban, suburban areas here in the Madison area. And it might be if you manage apartment buildings or something like that. But essentially to help you understand how to create, enhance, and manage habitat in these urban areas that would attract wildlife. So something positive for wildlife, and not just attracting raccoons, but maybe attracting salamanders or frogs or something that typically you wouldn't have in your property because the habitat wouldn't be there. And so we're offering a workshop in order to do that, and we're offering essentially 6 hours of in-class instruction over two different nights, September 13th and September 20th, at the in-class portion, will be at the UW Arboretum right off the Beltline. And then we're going to have a four-hour field trip on September 30th, I believe it is, on a Saturday afternoon, where we're going to go out and actually look around Madison and show the participants in the workshop things that we've been talking about in the class and how they can actually incorporate some of these into their own yards or their own urban properties. And we are, as an American, America, we are an urbanized population right now. About 85% of Americans live in urban settings. Roughly 70% of Wisconsinites live in what would be considered an urban setting. So that's where most people are interacting with wildlife, but that's also where most people have the ability to do something positive for wildlife. And so this urban wildlife workshop is an attempt to try to get people to do more positive things on their property for wildlife. Whether you own a quarter acre, city lot, or you own a condo or an apartment building, you've got a couple acres with that, or a corporate park, there's a lot that you can do on that property. And that's what this workshop is trying to do, is help you understand what types of wildlife are here in the city and what you can do to benefit those species. So.
And there's a lot here. I was just driving in this morning, and there was a hawk sitting on a street sign. I'm like, what is that doing here? There's some trees over there, so there must be something for them to eat.
Yeah,
there,
we've got bald eagles in Madison, a whole variety of hawks, owls, coyote, fox, mink, all this other assortment of things you'd expect, like raccoons, skunks, and things like that. And bobcats seem to be growing in population out in Iowa County, just west of here. And so I suspect that bobcats will be in Madison here soon enough. And that's another species that would be just wonderful to have here. So we're lucky.
Yeah, it sounds like a great workshop. Yeah. Where can people sign up?
Maybe we can put it up on the Facebook page or Larry Mueller Show page here, and people can find it that way. But also, if you just Google Dane County Urban Wildlife Workshop, it should come up that way as well.
Okay. And for those who don't have access to the internet, there's still some out there.
The best thing is to call, if you would like to call me at my office number, at 608-890.
You sure you want to do this?
I do. Yep. 890-0445. I'd be happy to help you. The cost for the workshop is $50, but that does cover a host of resources we're going to provide, some refreshments. And if you need some help affording that cost, there are some scholarships available at a 50% subsidy rate.
Well, wonderful. That sounds like fun. Next time you come on, Well, in October, actually, probably, yeah. Then you can report back and see how it went.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, please join us. We'd love to have you.
Okay. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. And we've been talking with David Drake. He's a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist. Do you have a wildlife question for him? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Coming up at 1 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn takes a look at a Milwaukee-based hands-on program that is helping to bring people of color into Milwaukee's commercial real estate industry. That's at 1 o'clock on the Ideas Network. And we're talking to David Drake. And David, we had someone who, I believe, was it called in? I'm not sure here. Anyway, a listener asked that about deer bucks having horns, and they probably misheard, but do they have horns this time of year or don't they?
Yes, they do. So I think the listener maybe, hopefully I didn't say it wrong, but
I think you said it right.
But the bucks definitely have antlers instead of horns.
Sorry.
Yeah, things like antelope have horns.
Cows
have horns. Deer, elk have antlers. And so, yes, the bucks will have antlers at this time of the year. So if I misspoke, I apologize. But you should see male deer out there with antlers on their heads right now.
And if it's a female deer with an antler, they're just spoofing you, right?
Well, they do call those antlerless deer.
Antlerless deer, that's right.
That also includes the young the young bucks that may not be developing the antlers.
Okay,
yet.
I think we've got that straight now. And we do have all of our lines filled, so let's go to them right away. We've got Kim in Wind Lake waiting. Hi, Kim.
Hi, how are you?
Well, what's your question?
We have I don't know what's going on, but all of a sudden we have a ton of chipmunks all over and underneath our deck, and they're even burrowing underneath our cement step. There's like holes in the grass all over the place. I don't know how to get rid of them, but I don't want to kill them, but I don't know if there's something else maybe you could suggest.
Yeah, Kim, that's a hard one. One of the reasons you may have so many chipmunks all of a sudden is, you know, certainly they have just come through breeding season and reproduction season, so some of the young ones are starting to get older and moving about, so that's a possibility. Chipmunks certainly move around. They're a burrowing rodent, as you know or may know, and so once they develop that burrow, they have a tendency to stay to that burrow, but they will certainly abandon burrows for a variety of reasons and move someplace else. So maybe something happened. Maybe there's some development going on, building going on nearby you, and that's caused the chipmunks to move or whatever the case is. In terms of getting rid of them, if you don't want to kill them, then your options really become live trapping them or some kind of exclusion. And we'll start with live trapping. So live trapping is you would get a Sherman live trap or some kind of a live trap that you would bait with peanut butter, and you would set those traps near the holes that you see in the ground or by your steps or whatever the case might be where you see the chipmunk's presence. The issue with live trapping is once you've caught them, it is illegal in the state of Wisconsin to release animals on property you don't own without that property owner's permission. And so it may be a little difficult for you to find somebody who's willing to take chipmunks, because just as you're experiencing problems with them, a lot of other people are also experiencing problems with them and would be remiss in saying, yes, bring all of your chipmunks to my property. So live trapping is a possibility. You can try exclusion, and this would be a pretty difficult thing to do in a normal, even in a city lot or a yard. But one thing you might want to think about doing is trying to, when chipmunks are excavating under your walkway or under your steps, then the possibility for that walkway, those steps to get undermined as the soil starts eroding or collapsing under the steps becomes a real issue. So what you might want to try to do is if either you do it yourself or someone in your family or hire a contractor to come and actually excavate a trench maybe a foot deep by a foot wide and put some chicken wire or hardware cloth or some kind of a metal fencing material that the animals can't sneak through. So the mesh size is small enough that the animals can't get through. And what you would do is you would bend that material into an L shape. So you would fence the vertical part of that trench, and then you would fence the horizontal or floor part of that trench, and then you would backfill that. And what happens then is the animals will start to burrow in, and they'll hit the vertical part of the wire. They then will start to reorient, and they'll hit the horizontal part of the wire, and they realize they can't get in, so they'll abandon that area and go someplace else. You most likely are still going to have them in your yard, but at least they're not going to be undermining the foundation of your house or your steps or whatever the case might be. If that sounds like too much, the other alternative then is to kill the chipmunks in some kind of a snap trap or a kill trap, and that's essentially would be using a rat trap that you would also bait with peanut butter, and then you would just set that near where the holes are or where you see the chipmunks, the presence of the chipmunks.
And does that even work? I mean, won't they just come back? Won't other just fill in?
Yep. So chipmunks are rodents, and with all rodents, they're prolific breeders. They're really the base of the food pyramid for a lot of other animals that eat them. So we have a lot of them around. And regardless of what you do, whether you a live trap, kill trap, do some kind of exclusion, it is a perpetual issue. And if you kill trap all of the animals out of there this season, it doesn't mean they're not going to be back next year.
And maybe a predator will come and
possibly,
because there's a lot of food there.
Yep,
so.
Possibly. But I'll just mention one last thing.
Okay.
We do have, Kim, if you want to go on, if you have internet access, if you go to wildlifedamage.uwex.edu, we have a fact sheet on chipmunks and 13-line ground squirrels, and we explain some of their ecology there, but also all the range of options you might have for managing them in your yard.
And good luck, Kim.
Yes.
All right, we have Matt calling from Elk Mound. Hi, Matt. Hi, Matt. Matt, are you there? Well, Matt apparently saw some unusual sparrow behavior and wanted to ask about it, but I don't know what it was. So, Matt, you're there?
Yep.
Oh, you weren't listening on the phone, were you? That's okay. What did you see?
Question I have is I'm wondering if I'd seen something unique or if it's just something that appeared to be different. But several years ago, I was working as a salesman for a car dealership, and my office had a big window, and outside the window was part of a driveway. And next to the driveway, there's some tall grass. And one day I was just watching these sparrows, and it would probably be about a group of six or eight of them, which appeared to two or three of them would land in the parking lot, and the rest of them would land in the grass behind it, and they would just jump up and down, and it sure looked like they were driving out grasshoppers to the standards out in the field. And I've watched this happen, over a week period, and it just seemed like they were actually literally driving these grasshoppers, and they're working as a team.
Okay.
But I haven't seen it since.
All right. Well, Matt, the quality of the phone is just a real bad, but I think you probably have enough information, David.
Yeah, absolutely, Matt. Thank you very much for calling in. That's a neat story. I'm not familiar with that behavior with sparrows, but that's certainly that feeding. Cooperative feeding behavior is not uncommon for a number of animals in the wildlife kingdom, where dolphins, for example, will run fish up on the bank of a shore, and then they'll take turns feeding out there. Or if you think about whales, bubble net feeding with krill. But certainly, mammals will do that. Birds will do that as well. And so it would not be unusual if that was actually what you were seeing, that they were actually cooperatively feeding to kind of herd the grasshoppers out for the birds that were in the parking lot, and then they probably would take turns doing that so that everybody could feed. And that's a pretty neat story.
It is.
Good observation.
Yeah, for sure. Our next call is Mary in Muskego. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
What's your question?
Okay, I have a question. I have a flying squirrel. I've got a couple of them, and I believe they're rare in this part of the country.
Are they rare?
No, Mary, that's another good observation. Flying squirrels are just awesome animals. They're one of the seven squirrel species we have in the state of Wisconsin here. One of the reasons people think that they're rare or may think they're rare is because they're nocturnal. And so they're active at night, and a lot of people just simply don't see them because we're in our house and we're not paying attention or we're sleeping or whatever the case is. But a lot of times if you have a bird feeder out with sunflower seed and you have a motion-censored backyard light, that when that light goes on, go out and look at the bird feeder, because a lot of times it's flying squirrels at the bird feeder that is eating. Or if you know that they're around, if you go out with your flashlight, usually you can see them kind of scurrying about in the trees and things like that. We have two species of flying squirrel in the state of Wisconsin. One's the southern flying squirrel, and the other's the northern flying squirrel.
That works out well.
It doesn't it? And you want to guess where they're found?
East and west, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. The southern flying squirrels are the smaller of the two species, but they seem to be the much more common of the two species. And so northern flying squirrels are typically, they inhabit the northern part of the state, but the southern flying squirrels seem to be expanding their range north in the state. And it appears that they may be actually pushing the northern flying squirrels further north out of the state. So even in the far reaches of northern Wisconsin, we're still seeing the more common species up there is southern flying squirrels.
Wow.
But they are awesome animals. You know, they're relatively small. They've got a flat, kind of a flat tail that they use to kind of steer themselves as they glide. And the flying portion of their name is a little bit of a misnomer. They don't actually fly. The only true flying mammal species we have is a bat. But what they do is they'll climb up into a tree, into an aerial perch, and then they glide, and they've got these flaps of skin between their wrist or their ankle and their body, and they open up their arms, and they kind of just glide like a wingman that you might see who's flying through the air with this wingsuit on. They're just fascinating animals.
Well, what's the difference now if we don't see them gliding? How can you tell it's a flying squirrel, not a regular ground squirrel or gray squirrel?
Well, so one thing that, the gray squirrels are bigger than even bigger than the northern flying squirrels, for example. And the flying squirrels have larger eyes relative to their head size because they're nocturnal. Right.
Okay.
And then you also, with the gray squirrel, for example, you see that great big bushy tail. With flying squirrels, the tail is not nearly as bushy, and it's much more of a flat tail than it is a round bushy tail.
All right. Well, look for those and let us know if you find any. And thank you very much for the call, Mary. Next up, we have Joan in Viroqua. Hi, Joan. Viroqua, I think.
Hello.
I said that wrong. What's your question?
Well, I was driving in a rural area towards DeSoto, Wisconsin, and I saw a doe with twin babies. And then shortly, a few miles down the road, I saw another doe with twin babies. And I just thought that was unusual.
Is it?
It can be, especially in the rural areas. So typically, I mean, it's not unusual for them to have twins or even triplets sometimes, for a female deer to have twins or triplets. But what that typically suggests is that the habitat around and the food and things like that is abundant enough that she can actually support carrying twins during the gestation period, but then also support feeding the twins, she's nursing them for the first part of their life. So it would be more unusual in rural areas than it would be in urban areas. In urban areas, you've got such a plethora of food that it's not terribly uncommon to see twins in urban areas. But in rural areas, it is a little bit, and it's a good sign that there's sufficient habitat there.
Would a mild winter have something to do with
it
that
could.
Too?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so, Joan, you should probably report that on the...
the Operation Deer Watch.
That's right, Operation Deer Watch. Okay. All right, well, our next caller is Jean in Shawano. Hi, Jean.
Hello.
What's your question?
First of all, I want to say this is very interesting, and thank you for having this topic on.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for listening.
I live out in the country, and I do have a bobcat close by. And I'm wondering if they eat house cats or if that's too close to their own species.
Well, there is cannibalism within the animal world. There's no doubt
yes,
about that.
Yes, there is.
So bobcats are a very efficient predator. You know, if a bobcat is hungry enough and a domestic cat is available, it wouldn't surprise me if they would eat that cat just for food. But typically bobcats, feed on rabbits and possibly younger deer, squirrels, things like that. So
they will take a deer down.
Yeah, they'll take some. Not a 200-pound buck, but they will certainly take down deer. And as a matter of fact, there's a DNR research project that's going on in Iowa County right now, where they're radio collaring bobcats and coyotes to look at their impact as predators on deer. But they certainly will eat, you know, some of the younger deer, or if you have an older injured deer or something like that. But bobcats, you know, they're not a terribly large animal. And so things like, you know, skunks, rabbits, squirrels, things like that are more likely to be in their prey base. And even though we have wildlife that live in and around human beings, and they certainly have access to a lot of human-provided food like trash or birdseed or whatever the case might be, that it, we find that they tip, you know, these animals are in these human dominant landscapes still do try to maintain a pretty native natural diet that you'd find out in the rural area. So Gene, it's probably, I'm not going to say no, they're not going to attack a domestic cat, but if they had a choice between a domestic cat and a rabbit, they're probably most likely going to go for the rabbit.
Well, and the rabbit probably put up less of a fight,
yes,
than a domestic cat.
Right.
At least the domestic cats that I'm aware of.
But that's neat you have those bobcats in your neighborhood.
Yeah, that sure is. And actually, you know, we had Gene from Ashland ask if it's okay to release animals trapped on private property onto public lands. And we're talking about releasing that. Can you do that?
No. So legally in Wisconsin, anytime you release animals on property, you do not own, be it public or private, need the permission of, if it's a private land, you need permission of that private landowner. If it's public land, you need permission of the manager of that public land.
All right. Well, thank you for clarifying that, and thank you for the question, Gene. Next up, we have, who do we have? Dave in Wausau. Hi, Dave.
Hey, great show. Thank you.
You're
for having me on. I drive a rural delivery route up in Marathon County, and we see eagles all the time, and it's always beautiful and never gets old. But just the other day, I noticed one doing what to me was unusual flying behavior. This is out over a cornfield, and he's swooping in very low at high speed, just and coming back out, almost like a jet fighter doing touch and go landings and takeoffs. And so it caught my attention, so I slowed down because I had never, I mean, you see that on water, but not usually they come down dressed in a carcass and flying very differently.
I think we just lost Dave.
Okay.
Obviously he's in a rural area.
Yeah.
But is that an unusual behavior?
Not necessarily unusual. I mean, you know, eagles are strong, fast flyers, and who knows what was in that cornfield, but if there was some prey item it was trying to find there, or what was going on, or if it was just curious, you know, maybe it was just drafting on the wind currents or whatever the case might be. But it is neat to see them, and eagles are also a scavenging bird, so a lot of animals, for example, if a deer gets hit by a car, it hasn't gotten killed upon the impact and it's able to wander into the cornfield and it dies in the cornfield, you know, maybe that's what the eagle is looking for, is finding something like that where there's a carcass there that wants to scavenge, possibly. So the specific reason why it was doing that, I'm not sure, but it's not an uncommon sight for them to do that. And it is neat to see so many eagles. And one thing, we have a lot of them in Wisconsin, and I if I remember the statistic correctly, Wisconsin has contributed eagles to, I think, 13 or 17 different states in the country to help them repopulate their eagle population. So we've got great habitat here. The DNR and eagles obviously are a federally protected species as well. So the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service have done a phenomenal job of managing the population to the point where they've really recovered nicely. And we've got a very good population of eagles in Wisconsin.
Well, wasn't Wisconsin the leader in bringing back the eagles?
It was one of them, yeah,
mm-hmm,
absolutely.
That's what I had thought. So obviously it worked really well. We've got Jolie up next in Vilas County. Hi, Jolie.
Hello.
What's your question?
What I'm calling about is snakes in a boat.
Okay.
We have a little run.
Was that a movie?
And we had snakes that would get underneath the floorboard of the boat, and you'd come out in the morning and you'd see them, and then they'd slither, they'd be sunning themselves, and then they'd slither into underneath, and we'd try to get them out. Finally, what my husband did is, because he wanted to go for a boat ride, is he just grabbed them and he threw them in the water, and they were a good 3-4 feet. This is the northern water snake.
Okay, yep.
Threw them out. But I don't want them back in
sure.
there. we brought our boat up and we have it on the trailer, but if I want to keep it on the dock, I think they want to party in that boat again.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Yeah, so northern water snake is a non-venomous snake here in Wisconsin, one of our snake species. It is typically, as the name implies, found around water. And they're kind of a banded, so they have kind of vertical, almost like half moon bands. And this is not the best description, but almost half moon bands that are vertical along their side, kind of a brownish reddish type snake, things like that. And they are non-venomous, but they can be an aggressive snake. So they can, you know, they will certainly, if they're handled, they'll bite at you and they might charge at you a little bit, things like that. But they can't hurt you.
They're bluffing.
Yeah. So one thing to do is if you can get your boat up, and I'm not sure, get your boat on, if it's on the lift, get it up as high out of the water as you possibly can. But snakes obviously are good climbers. They're good slitherers, you know, they certainly can come through the water as well. So one thing you might want to do is on the legs of your boat lift is get a barrier similar to what you would put on the pole for your bird feeders, this baffle, this kind of a cone baffle,
right,
and put that on each leg so that they can't climb up the leg of your boat lift as a possibility. If they're coming off the dock, and I'm not sure how close the dock is to the boat lift, but if they're coming off the dock, if there's some kind of a barrier you can put up, maybe some kind of a little fence that you would put that would be angled as the fence is coming off the dock, it would be angled in a way that the snakes can't get up and over that fence, because they can certainly climb fences, but they cannot support their body weight upside down on that fence. So angle the fence in a way that they can't actually get up and over.
Not like a ramp to the boat, but
yeah,
like
right.
Backwards.
Yep. Okay. And the other option is, you know, if they do get into the boat, into the floorboards, because that's where they're sunning themselves, if you can reduce the amount of sun. So I don't know if your boat lift has an awning on it, but if you can get that boat up under the awning, that might reduce the reason for them being there, because you've taken the sun away from them. And finally, if there's anything you can jam in between the boat, sides of the boat and the boat floor, so that they can't get under the floorboards, at least you can keep them on the floorboards. And then you can buy a snake tong if you want, or a snake hook. And if you don't want to handle them with your hands, you can buy a snake tong or a snake hook, and then you can just have that in the boat at the ready to get the snakes overboard if you want to try that.
Make a game out of it,
yeah.
Right? To have all your guests with a snake tong,
yep, exactly.
And we'll see how many they can get.
Exactly.
Out. Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you so much for calling with that question.
Yeah, that's a good question.
It is.
Unusual. Yeah.
I've never heard that. I'm sure Larry probably has, but I certainly haven't. So thank you, Jolie. Up next, we have Alexandra in Ashland. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi.
What do you have for us?
I had a question about mountain lions. My sister was driving from Superior, Wisconsin to Bayfield, Wisconsin, and along her journey, it was around twilight, a mountain lion darted in front of her vehicle, and I know they don't have any established populations in Wisconsin. I'm just kind of curious what their migratory patterns are like and if they're moving this time of year.
Well, so mountain lions, we call mountain lions here out west. They definitely call mountain lions. Sometimes we refer to them as cougars here in the state of Wisconsin as well. So I'm not familiar or aware that there are mountain lions or cougars in the state right now. There very well might be. They are becoming more of a common occurrence. Not that we've got a population of them, but, you know, individuals here and there. Alexander, if you want to go onto the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources website and just type into the search box mountain lion or cougar, or call the biologist in your county and ask them if there have been any sightings, then they'd be able to tell you if what your sister saw actually was a mountain lion. But mountain lions don't migrate. They typically will set up a territory. They will kick the young males out of that territory. So those young males will have to move to find another territory someplace else.
No basements for them, right?
No, exactly. So, exactly. And they'll have to also, you know, find territory and then establish a breeding population and things like that. But with that being said, The mountain lions that have been seen in Wisconsin since maybe 2006 or 2008 have seem to have all come out of the South Dakota population, because that population is starting to grow and filling up the habitat in South Dakota. So those animals that are getting kicked out of those areas are moving someplace else and they're coming into Wisconsin. The most interesting mountain lion story yet is that there was a mountain lion that came, and it was one of the first ones that was noted in Wisconsin in decades. It came out of South Dakota. It was seen in Wisconsin, and then the DNR lost it. It turned out that it had made its way all the way to Connecticut, and it had gotten killed by a car, I think almost a year after it was seen in Wisconsin. It had gotten killed by a car about 30 or 40 or 50 miles just west of the Atlantic Ocean. So it almost made it all the way to the Atlantic Ocean. But that mountain lion had made a journey essentially almost 1,100 miles, and that was the longest distance movement of a mountain lion ever recorded. So it came from South Dakota, and they think it did come into Wisconsin. They think it came up and went up into Canada above one of the lakes and then kept on going. But to make it that far,
that's amazing.
Is incredible. Yeah.
You wonder why.
Well, it probably kept on moving. It either got kicked out of areas because of people or for whatever reason, it just kept on moving looking for probably a female.
Oh, well, that makes sense. It does.
But they are not typically migratory animals. Mm-hmm. But that was an unusual journey for that one particular animal.
Well, more great information here on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and I'm sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. We're talking with David Drake. He's a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist. And we do have a couple of open phone lines. So if you have a question for him, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Tomorrow at this time, our consumer protection experts are back to warn us about the latest scams and take your questions. So hope you can join us for that. Always very informative. And we just wanted to let you know that Davin Wassa, whose phone dropped out, called back to finish his story about the eagles that were in a cornfield, I believe it was. Well, it turns out the eagle was trying to shoo two juveniles away from the farmer's driveway. So is he employed by the farmer, do you think?
Yeah, David? I wonder. Pretty neat.
Yeah, that sounds like it was a pretty neat observation. Our phone lines are full right now, so let's go right back to the phones. And we have Dean in Mount Horeb who has a question for us. Hi, Dean.
Hi. I have a question on woodchucks. Had some, I think they may have been under our porch. Now there's one in our barn, and we see them come out of the corner of the barn every now and again, usually on a daily basis. We'll run out and come back in. Just wondering, I heard you mention that you can't trap and release them except on land you own. Just wondering, what's the best way to get rid of it?
So woodchucks, also called groundhogs. The best thing, probably, they're not a protected species here in Wisconsin. So on property you own where the damage is occurring, you are legal to euthanize or kill that animal. So if you wanted to... if it's legal where you live, Dean, to discharge a firearm, if you see the animal up and above the ground, you're legal to shoot the animal if you want to do that. If you want to live trap the animal and then euthanize it in some humane way, you're welcome to do it that way as well. If you live trap the animal, use apple or plum tomatoes or something like that. Put the trap right next to the hole that has the largest mound of soil in front of the hole. That's the primary entrance exit. And then if you also would put a blanket or burlap sack or something like that over the trap, that will kind of enclose the trap and make that animal feel like it's going into a burrow. And so it doesn't feel like it's out in the open if you don't cover that trap up. So if you cover the trap with a blanket or old towel or something like that, you're more likely to get that animal to come into the trap for you. So you can try that. The other thing you can try is to put gas cartridges into the burrow itself and actually asphyxiate the animal using that gas cartridge. But gas cartridges have a number of side effects to them. One is that there's a fire hazard associated with particular types of gas cartridges. And if you have a porous type of soil, that gas could actually leak up through the soil into your barn or into your living quarters. So where the burrows are underneath buildings, it's not necessarily recommended to use gas cartridges for because of the fire hazard or also the gas hazard itself. So it really becomes a trapping issue, or if you're legal to discharge a firearm where you live, to perhaps use a firearm in that capacity.
And David, Dean had mentioned about not being able to release the animal unless you own the mm-hmm. property, but that's not exactly correct, right? You can if you have permission from the property
yes,
owner.
Yes, if you have permission from the property owner where you're releasing that animal, you're welcome to release as many animals as that property owner is allowing you to do so.
Okay. Just want to make that clear. Let's go to Tom in Independence. Hi, Tom.
Hi. So I live in Independence, and I've got property on the Trempealeau River, and I've got bull snakes, and I've got garter snakes. I was in my shed this spring, and I heard a buzzing noise. Sounded like almost like a bumblebee. And I move a bag aside, and looked like a chocolate brown snake, about a foot and a half long, and its tail was buzzing, but it moved so fast I couldn't identify it much more than that, but it's definitely not a bull snake. What do you think it might have been?
Tom, Trempealeau County, remind me where that is. Is that in the southwestern part of the state?
Yes, between Eau Claire and La Crosse.
Yeah, so we have two species of venomous snakes in Wisconsin, both rattlesnakes. One is the timber rattlesnake, and the other is the... it's a smaller, it'll come to me. I'm sure as soon as I leave the radio program, it's going to come to me. It's a smaller rattlesnake, but that smaller rattlesnake is typically associated more with the Mississippi River Valley. Timber rattlesnakes could possibly be up in your area. But there's a number of, rattlesnakes, however, they have, kind of a diamond shaped head, a broad head. I know when I say this, a lot of people say, well, I'm not going to get close enough to look at that snake. But in the eye, it's more of a cat-shaped eye versus a round pupil. And then with timber rattlesnakes, they have some very distinct black bands on their body. But there are other snakes that will also rattle their tail to mimic rattlesnake to try to scare predators off. And one of those would be a hognose snake. Another snake would be a rat snake. So maybe look those two snakes up and see if either one of those snakes looked like the snake you saw. Rat snakes in particular can have quite a bit of colorations. They can be gray, black, brownish, things like that. Hognose snakes are interesting in the sense that they will try to hiss at you. They'll try to shake their tail in dried leaves or vegetation to try and mimic rattlesnake. And if none of that works, they roll over and play dead. So it's unlikely it was a hognose snake based on your description that the snake took off. I'm guessing if it wasn't a rattlesnake, it might have been a rat snake. But take a look at timber rattlesnake and take a look at rat snake and hognose snake and see what you think. The other rattlesnake that just came to me is the Massasauga rattlesnake.
Oh, no wonder you couldn't remember it.
Yeah, so Massasauga. But Massasauga rattlesnakes are the smaller of the two rattlesnake species, and they are more tightly tied to the Mississippi River Valley.
Okay, all right. Well, that was interesting because I had not realized we had so many different snakes that kind of rattled in Wisconsin. All right. We've got Jeff in Madison up next. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Just a question. About 15, 20 years ago, growing up on a dairy farm, my brother and I were out doing field chores, and in the late afternoon, early evening, we were driving a tractor through the field, and we came across what we absolutely swear was a bull moose.
All right.
We related that story to our parents, my brother and I, and other family members who said that we were nuts.
Well.
So listening to the story about the cougar and how far that traveled, is it possible that there are moose in Wisconsin, and particularly in South Central Wisconsin, north of Mount Horeb?
Yes, you were sober, right, at the time?
Absolutely.
Okay. We do have the occasional moose in Wisconsin, but typically they're going to come in where Wisconsin borders Michigan or borders Minnesota, and typically further north. So South Central Wisconsin, unless it was an escape moose, from a zoo or something like that, it would be really, really unusual. But as we've learned to say, we never say never. And, if you see a bull moose, they are really, really hard to confuse with much else. especially, you know, if that animal had antlers on its head at that time you saw it, that rack is really
huge.
It's very, very large, and it is hard to confuse with anything else. So I'm not going to say no. You could never see that, because who knows what occurs out there. But it would be very, very unlikely if it was a free-ranging wild species of moose.
We need a picture.
Yeah, I think so.
We need a picture. So,
but with Photoshop these days, you know, you get all sorts of different kind of pictures that look true.
Absolutely.
But Jeff, that's a good story, and I don't, who knows?
Yeah, who knows? You know, we got a gorgeous picture from Mike on Facebook of an albino buck, and he was saying he looks kind of old, but apparently there was an older one with him. Why don't you talk a little bit about some of the albino deer that we have in the state?
Yeah, but I can't see the picture, Jill, just because I'm so far away. I forgot to bring my glasses today. But for it to be a true albino, it would have to be all white, which this one is, and it would have to have a pink nose
and pink eyes. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And so
it is.
Okay, so that's a true albino. Mm-hmm. We also have deer that are white but are not true albinos that we call piebald deers,
right.
And so they're primarily white without the pink nose and pink eyes. And white deer are protected in the state of Wisconsin. So I believe it's illegal. I'm thinking back on this, but I'm almost positive it's illegal to shoot those deer, even during the harvest season.
Yeah, I believe you're right. Mm-hmm.
But that's a pretty impressive picture, and it's just shocking because it's white out amongst all this green, and it really stands out.
Now, there's a population that's a little bit, it's more up north, right?
Yep, more central and north. That's right.
Okay.
Yep, absolutely.
All right. And then real quick, we only have a few more seconds before we go off, but what's the name of the deer survey that we can take?
Operation Deer Watch. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, yes. Operation Deer Watch.
Yep. So go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and in the keyword search engine, just type in Deer Watch, and that survey and how to conduct the survey and how to register your tallies will show up.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that with us. We've been talking with David Drake. He's a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist. And we were talking about Operation Deer Watch, and we're going to be talking about migrating birds and all kinds of really great wildlife topics. And there's some birds that are in Wisconsin right now that usually you don't see here. So stay with us on the Ideas Network. There's so much more to come. You're listening to another informative wildlife show here on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najoe, and I'm sitting in for the vacationing Larry Mueller. David Drake is our guest today. He is a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist. And we, of course, are welcoming your wildlife calls, comments, and sightings. Join our conversation. You can do that by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can also send us an email. That address is ideas@wpr.org. And of course, you can post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. We're always looking for some really cool wildlife photos, and we have some today, but we always like more. And David, you know, before we go back to the phones, let's talk a little bit about birding.
Okay.
You told us earlier that the birds are starting to migrate already.
Yeah,
it's only August.
I know. So we still have a good month of summer left, so nobody panic. It is an indication that summer's coming to an end, because we've got birds that are starting to migrate through, and in particular, shorebirds. So we've got a number of shorebirds that will be here in Wisconsin. I mean, we've got piping plovers and then other types of birds that are here in Wisconsin as shorebirds. But a lot of them go up to the far reaches of northern Canada, up into the tundra, to nest, and then they will migrate from there after the breeding season all the way down to the northernmost southern part of their area is, if it makes sense of that, is, along the Gulf Coast of the United States, so Texas, Florida, things like that. But quite a few of them go all the way down to South America. So they've got a long-distance migration to go from the top of Canada into the northern part of South America. Some of them go into the central part of South America. Some of the terns go all the way down into Patagonia, Argentina. So, you know, some of the terns migrate 11,000 miles one way, and they do that twice a year. So the birds that are coming through now are shorebirds, like some of the sandpipers, like least sandpiper, semi-palmate sandpiper, stilt sandpiper, things like that. There's a short-billed dowitcher out there. And so a lot of the shorebirds that are coming through, and they're being seen over in Horicon Marsh and in Fond du Lac Fond du Lac County area over there. So start looking out for them. You know, in the birding community, shorebirds are a wonderful thing to see, but they can be a confusing type of bird because a lot of the sandpipers look alike.
They do.
They do. Yeah. And they're small, and a lot of times they're a distance away, so you've got to use a spotting scope. But, you know, in terms of identifying them, you're looking for bill length, route of bill length, bill shape. Is it straight? Is it curved downward, curved upward? Leg size, you know, the length of the leg, and then also the coloration and the markings on the birds as well. But
or you can just check off Piper.
Sandpiper, yeah.
Yeah, Sandpiper, yeah,
exactly.
On your list.
Exactly. But there's been some pretty neat things coming through. So black-necked stilts, Hudsonian godwits, Wilson's phalaropes, short-billed dowitchers, I think we talked about, yellow legs, American avocets, things like that. So they're starting to move, and that is an indication that summer's going to come to an end here eventually.
But not yet. We're
no,
still
that's
good.
Right. That's right.
And there were some birds spotted that are actually kind of rare.
Yeah, so I'm not familiar with these sightings here in Wisconsin, but apparently in some neighboring states, and I'm not sure which states we're talking about, but in some of the neighboring states, apparently somebody's seen a wood stork and a roseate spoonbill, which are birds that you typically, if you go down to Florida or Texas or places like that,
right,
you'd see. And this is far, far north for them to be. But roseate spoonbills are just phenomenal-looking birds. They're kind of a pinkish bird, like a flamingo would be.
Really?
But they're called spoonbills because their spoon looks like a spoon. And then wood storks, if we don't have many storks in America, but they're a tall white bird, but then their bill actually looks like a piece of wood and is really distinguishing.
Oh, neat. I'm going to look that up when I get to a computer because that really looks like a pretty cool bird.
The last bird I'll mention really quick is apparently people have seen rufous hummingbirds here in Wisconsin. In the eastern half of the United States, the only hummingbird species that's common to the eastern half of the United States is the ruby-throated hummingbird.
Mm-hmm.
So rufous hummingbirds are typically far west in California, Nevada, up and down the West Coast, things like that. So for a rufous hummingbird to be here, it's pretty interesting. There, if you're familiar with hummingbirds, and I know a lot of people who listen feed hummingbirds,
yes,
you know they're territorial. They defend that feeder. The rufous hummingbird is the feistiest of all the hummingbird species, and the males are bright orange. They've been described as in really good sunlight, like a glowing ember or a glowing piece of coal, because they're such bright orange. And so they're really much different looking than our ruby-throated hummingbirds if you ever see them here in the state of Wisconsin.
All right. Well, if you do see those, please call the show, especially
absolutely.
On a Wednesday. We want to know.
A picture, not Photoshop, but get a real picture.
Send it in. All right. Not that our listeners would ever do that, David. So let's go back to the phone. First up, we have Ruby in Portage. Rudy. Hi, Rudy.
Oh, good afternoon. Thank you for taking the call. I enjoy listening to the show. I always get some great ideas for what I can do around the house that I rent near Portage. I got a mole problem.
Okay.
are there any other kind of moles but problems? Yeah.
Well, you know, I rent the place, but I'm responsible to take care of the yard, and I like to have a nice-looking yard and everything, and I get the veins that pop up. It was suggested to me to, you know, you can put chewing gum down in there. One individual actually told me, and I would never do this, it's cruel, but he says, get yourself a six-pack, a chair, and a shovel, and just be patient.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, you'll see them digging, for sure.
But is there anything that's kind of more humane than just how to get rid of these things?
Yeah, Rudy, so it sounds like you've correctly identify the animal, but let me just double check with you really quick. So these are the raised tunnels that you see in your yard, and when you walk in across the yard, the soil collapses beneath your foot.
Absolutely.
Yep. Okay. So we've got two species of moles, and we're talking moles, M-O-L-E. One is the eastern, or also called the common mole, and the other is the star-nosed mole. Eastern or common moles are in more well-drained upland soils. The star-nosed mole is in the soil type that is more typically moist, and the soil is meeting some kind of a water body, like a lake or a river or whatever. So I'm guessing you've got, based on your description and where you live, I'm guessing you've got the eastern or common mole. And even though a lot of people will say, I've got tunnels everywhere, I must have a whole family of moles, typically there's one mole for about every 3/4 to 1 acre. So even though you've got a lot of tunnels, it's usually just one animal that's created that tunnel system because they're constantly swimming through the soil looking for food. And their primary food source are earthworms, but they also eat grubs and things like that. So one thing you can do is sprinkle in some castor oil mixed with water. And you can sprinkle that into your yard, and nobody's exactly sure why that works, but what is thought to happen is that castor oil water mixture probably irritates the skin of the worms, and it causes the worms to migrate out of the yard. So essentially what you're doing is you're trying to reduce or eliminate the food source for the mole. If the food isn't there, then the mole has to go someplace else also. Alternatively, you can also buy over the internet, or sometimes garden centers will offer these, but it's an environmentally friendly nematode, a type of parasite that you also would then sprinkle into the soil, and that nematode will eat the worms faster than the moles can. And again, you're trying to reduce or eliminate the food source. I think the easiest thing to do, if you're not opposed to killing the mole, and moles are not protected species, there's plenty of them out there, is to get yourself a Victor harpoon trap, and you can buy these for about $15 or $20 from Menards or Home Depot. And pay attention to the side of the box. They have very explicit directions, but the key to using a mole trap successfully is to find that main tunnel that the animal is running, which is typically the longest and relatively straightest. It's not going to be straight like an arrow, but it's not going to have as many curves in it as the side tunnels you'll see. So try to get a harpoon trap, and that also I think is a very successful, and to me it's the easiest way to deal with a mole. And usually, like I said, you're probably dealing with just one mole, and once you get rid of that one mole, you don't have to deal with the mole problem for a while.
Well, that's amazing. One mole can take up that much space.
Yep.
Now, you spelled mole with an M.
Yes.
What's the difference between a mole with an M and a vole with a V?
One letter.
One, thank you.
Yeah, so.
I set you up for that one.
Yeah, voles, moles are, we consider them insectivores because they do eat those earthworms. They're a mammal species. Moles are about 6 to 8 inches long, something like that. And almost solely subterranean, so they live almost the entire life underneath the soil. Voles, V-O-L-E, we've got 4 different species of vole in the state of Wisconsin. So we've got the redback vole, which is more of a forest-associated species you find up in the northern part of the state. We've got a woodland or pine vole, which is more associated with a hardwood forest, where you have hardwood forest. And of the 4 vole species, that typically is the more subterranean, so that will be more underground than the other 3 species. We have a prairie vole species, which is associated with prairies, and it's thought to be not all that populated or common in the state of Wisconsin. And then probably the most common species that most people see is the meadow vole, and that is associated with meadows, pastures, but you also see it in your yard, and particularly people notice them a lot of times at the end of winter when the snow starts to melt. If you see those runways that are through your grass, those are created by meadow voles.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, excellent. Thanks for
and
that.
And voles are probably, the body of a vole might be 2 to 3 inches at the most. And
tiny.
Yeah, there's a much smaller animal. And they're typically above ground, whereas moles are below ground.
There you go. You got it here first. Let's go back to the phones then. We've got Susan in Madison who has a question.
Hi. Thank you. I live on the east side and... we've lived there since 85, and we've always had small dogs and cats. And a couple of years ago, we had a coyote problem where coyotes were getting into people's yards and killing their small dogs. We've not seen any kind of that aberrant coyote behavior in like over a year now. And we've had coyotes since we've lived there in the area. We've always had them. We were told it was probably just one rogue coyote, and he may be gone. Is it safe to assume that he's gone if we've not seen any of that kind of behavior?
Susan, that's a good question. As I mentioned earlier on, we've got a study here in Madison that I'm conducting where we are radio collaring coyotes and red fox in the city of Madison. And I will tell you this, with the exception of downtown along the isthmus, and so for people not familiar with Madison, this is maybe going to be unfamiliar for you, but with the exception of the extreme downtown area, there's probably not an area in Madison where there are not coyotes. And so even though you're not seeing them or they're not creating a problem, I guarantee you they are still in your area and still in your neighborhood or in the general vicinity of your neighborhood. So what we typically tell people to do, and you're right, typically it might just be one rogue animal or one animal is becoming overly aggressive or habituated to people and is losing their fear of people and starts to attack pets for a variety of reasons. And you know, I understand how upsetting that is to a pet owner, especially if it's your dog or your cat, but coyotes are just being coyotes. I mean, they're acting like they would out in the wild, even though they're in the city. But what we tell people to do is just don't get complacent. And if anytime you see a coyote, we really want you to enjoy seeing that animal in the landscape. But after you enjoy seeing that animal, scare the animal so that it moves away from you, and scare it by yelling at it, waving your arms in big circles, maybe picking up some rocks or sticks and throwing it toward the animal, not at the animal, so you don't want to hit the animal, but toward the animal. Or do something else to scare the animal. And the proper response from that animal is it should move away from you. It may not run away from you. It may just turn around and saunter off kind of in this arrogant walk. but as long as it moves away from you, that harassment or that hazing that you've done is working. And that's the best thing we can do as humans is to put the fear of humans into those coyotes. Because they're going to be here in the city living with us whether we want them here or not. And the best way to keep them from creating problems, especially from attacking pets, is to have them fear humans.
Okay. All right. Then let's go. Let's see. Who do we have up next? Oh, we've got Sylvia in Appleton. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi. I have a comment about the gentleman saying he was not getting swallows nesting. The last two springs, I think, have been very difficult for the swallows. We've been seeing them flying extremely low over the waters, any place where it's wet, trying to find insects because I think the bug population is down. So they may not be nesting because I think the adults are having trouble finding food. Also, David, a couple of months ago, some people called in about merlins.
Yes, I remember that.
Seeing them in the city, and they are nesting in the cities. There's at least been three here in Appleton. I have some birding friends in Sheboygan, and they actually had them in their backyard nesting in a pine tree.
And it was merlins for a fact and not peregrine falcons?
No, this was merlins.
Because, I mean, peregrines don't typically nest in trees.
No,
they nest on top of buildings.
These are merlins.
Yeah. Okay, excellent.
You were thinking they were something else.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's great.
And matter of fact, I watched the pair that's someplace near me here in Appleton dive bombing a redtail a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, wow. That's pretty neat. Yep. That is pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that call and the additional information about Merlin. So, yeah, what she's referring to, last time we were on, Jamie and I had made the mention that Merlins, I didn't think that they nested in Wisconsin. And the birding community is very, very passionate, and they quickly corrected me that they've got Merlins nesting in good parts of the state here. And so, yes, to make that correction, there are Merlins nesting in the state of Wisconsin, and certainly it sounds like in the backyard of some of Sylvia's friends. So the swallows, swallows are primarily insectivores, but I think that there's a variety of reasons why they may or may not be here. I'm not sure that swallow population is reduced at all. And we've got they might have moved around. We've got a number of different swallow species that call Wisconsin home during the breeding season. But I'm not aware of any issues with the reduction of swallow populations in the state of Wisconsin.
All right. Thank you for bringing that up to us, Sylvia. We're talking with David Drake. He's a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist. If you've got a question about wildlife or a comment or a sighting, please give us a call. We have open lines, 1-800-642-1234. And next up is Kurt in Wausau. Hi, Kurt. Kurt, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, what do you have for us?
I'm sorry, what?
What question do you have for us?
It's I was just wondering about this thing we've been watching for the last 4 years. It's we've been sighting these green bats that have no hair on them. Several witnesses over this period of time. It's multiple times a week we see it. Just depends on what time of night it is. Could be between 10:30 at night and 1:00 in the morning. But you clearly see they're green. They look like the undercolor of a leaf, and they don't have any hair. We've got like five of them.
Huh.
Have you ever gotten a picture, Kurt?
No, it's
too hard at night.
In. Yeah, they come swooping in underneath my canopy, and they shoot between the garage and my one tree. And to try to put a trail cam there, I don't think it would be enough split seconds for it to, because they go pretty fast.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. Have you heard anything?
No,
like
of, not of green hairless bass. The one thing I might suggest, Kurt, is to get in touch with Paul White. He's the chief bat ecologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and they've got a phenomenal, very active bat program through the Wisconsin DNR, and maybe contact him and see if he's familiar or something like that. The one thing I would maybe ask is, for sure they're hairless, because
we've got several witnesses. I mean, it's like we've been watching them for like 4 years here, so.
Okay.
And they all take the same route, and then they quit last year because I didn't have my canopy cut out far enough, so they changed their trajectory, so we weren't seeing them. And then once I cut my tree plant, I ended up the branches out again, then they came flying back through the way they used to.
Huh. Yeah, so I'm not familiar with green hairless bats. I mean, there are some bats that, you know, they're as mammals, they could possibly, I would suspect, contract mange, which can cause them to lose some fur. But hairless bats, I'm not familiar with any of those in the state of Wisconsin. There are bats that have, you know, short hair, and it might appear to be hairless, but... And green, that's the other thing, is the color. I mean,
there was a green puppy that was born up in Scotland. I saw it on Facebook, so it's got to be true.
We've got bats that are reddish, and we've got a red bat, and we've got a silver-haired bat, hoary bats, you know, which appear kind of whitish. But in terms of green bats and hairless bats, I'm not familiar. So I would maybe call Paul White and see if he has more knowledge about this than I do.
Okay, Kurt, we'll make that call and let us know, please. We've got one more call here from Dick in Deerfield. Hi, Dick.
Hello. Thanks for the call.
You bet.
I'd like to know more about kestrel nesting and box size and where to locate a nest and how high off the ground, et cetera.
Yep. So kestrels are similar to a merlin. You know, they're kind of in the falcon family. Really interesting birds. They typically are out in more of an open countryside, kind of prairie, grassland type area. And so they are they're cavity nesters, and so that's the reason they use a nest box. So a lot of times you'll see nest boxes put up on telephone poles, maybe 15, 20 feet above the ground, something like that. And Dick, I'm not familiar, or I'm not, I guess I'm not familiar enough off the top of my head to give you the specific dimensions of a kestrel box. And a lot of times with cavity nesters, it's the diameter of the hole going into that box that is key. But if you go on the internet, if you have internet access, and just Google or find some search engine and type in kestrel nest box, I guarantee you that you'll see a whole host of different nest box construction plans and things like that. And you might want to just double check a couple of them to make sure that the measurements and the hole size and things like that are consistent across the plans that you're looking at.
Yeah, that sounds like a fun project. Let us know how that goes. I think we have one more short call here. You know, Amy, why don't you give us your question real quick? Amy in Stoddard.
Yeah, hi. I just noticed, I live on Stoddard, and we actually live in an old barn, and half the barn is finished and half the barn is original. And we noticed, you know, last year we had a ton of bats in the barn. That's kind of normal on the other half. And this year there's hardly any, and there's a lot more bugs. And
yep.
I've heard through the grapevine that there's something like a white fungus,
going
on with the bat population.
Yep.
And so is there like something we can be doing to help them bounce back? Or?
Oh, that's a big question, huh?
So quickly, there's the white nose syndrome that is affecting bat populations and decreasing the number of bats in the state of Wisconsin. So a couple of things you can do to help bats, put up bat boxes, decrease the amount of use of herbicides or insecticides in your area so that they have food sources, and educate people about what they can do to help bats.
All right. Well, thank you, David, so much for being with us today. And thanks to our executive producer, Michelle Johnson, and to Dave Potras for being our technical director. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Stay with us. More to come.